This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
On The Nolan Show today, from the Stormont break to business class travel by government ministers and lots of the callers. My last day for 2024. No, don't be putting the flags out just yet. It's not my last day at the BBC, or at least not that I know about. I'll be back. Just got off from a Christmas holiday. So happy Christmas, everyone. Have a happy new year. And I hope you enjoy today's show.
The Stephen Nolan Show.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. It's my last Nolan Show of 2024. Happy Christmas, everyone. So our top story today, the EU. You will be hearing about this in the news today. The European Union is applying new rules on packaging and labelling of chemicals. And because of everything that's happened, those rules will also apply in Northern Ireland. Despite the UK leaving the EU, these labelling rules around chemicals will apply in Northern Ireland. And unionists want to stop that because, at the end of the day, it is further divergence from the rest of the UK where those rules will not apply. So what you will also be hearing about today, and this is as important a story as the labelling. The bigger story here is about what you will be told about in the news, the Stormont break. Because actually, how effective is the Stormont break? The Stormont break has been sold to you as a mechanism through which the pipeline of EU law automatically applying in Northern Ireland has been cut. You'll hear in a moment the DUP promising you that is what they had achieved. So at the end of the day, now that the Stormont break will be applied for the first time, what's going to happen in Northern Ireland is it's going to be a test. How effective is that Stormont break? So when the pedal is pushed, does it actually stop anything? That's the story. That's the bigger story. Now, it needs the support of 30 Assembly members from at least two parties for it to be triggered. We're going to talk through all of this today. But first of all, let's hear how Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, the DUP leader at the time, was the leader, obviously, of the party. Let's hear how emphatic he was about what he had achieved with regards to EU law applying in Northern Ireland.
Let us deal, first of all, Stephen, with the automatic pipeline of EU law. Under the Northern Ireland Protocol, EU law automatically flows in respect of a defined number of areas.
And this is Section 7A. That's that pipeline.
And that's it covers, let's not get the idea that EU law has primacy in Northern Ireland. Last time I checked, Stephen, when we drive on our roads, we drive at miles per hour. Our currency is sterling. We have different fiscal regimes here. There are many huge differences between us and the EU. Most of the laws that are impacting our lives are UK laws. They are not EU laws. But EU law does apply in certain respects to the manufacture of goods in Northern Ireland. And under the Northern Ireland Protocol, any change to that law, any new law introduced in that area, automatically applied to Northern Ireland. What we have secured, Stephen, and this is important, we have cut the pipeline. The first thing and the first key element when we talk about the Stormont break is EU law no longer automatically applies in Northern Ireland. We have dealt with what was called dynamic alignment, and that has ended. So what happens? If the EU proposes a new law which would impact on Northern Ireland, Stormont has the right to say, no, we do not believe it's right that that law should apply because it would be harmful to Northern Ireland. There is then the UK government then enters into a process whereby it will examine that law. It will consider its impact on the UK and its internal market, on Northern Ireland's ability to trade with the rest of the UK. Yes, because it's an EU law, it will consult with the EU in the joint committee because it's EU law we're talking about. But ultimately, Stephen, and this is there in the legislation passed by Parliament, so this is already passed, this is already approved by Parliament. the UK government ultimately has the veto and can exercise that veto and can stop that EU law.
This is why I'm grateful for...
And that is the way it should be.
Well, that this is why I'm grateful for you being in front of me today. Two questions around that, then let's move on. First of all, in that consultation which you've agreed will happen between the UK and the EU, you are banking on the UK, if we talk about the current administration, putting Northern Ireland ahead, if there was a fundamental disagreement with the EU, putting Northern Ireland ahead of UK-wide interests.
No, because...
So why would the UK back the DUP or the Northern Irish MLAs rather than protect the relationship with the EU and work it out with them?
Well, for
So yes, UK has primacy, but they're going to try to do it in consultation with and agreement with the EU.
No, Stephen, because this is EU law, there is a process that enables a discussion to take place in the Joint Committee. But ultimately, the UK government has a veto over that EU law. That is written into the new arrangements that have been approved and passed by Parliament. Now, if we get a situation where an EU law applies that is harmful to Northern Ireland's place in the United Kingdom, and the UK government refuses to veto that law, then, yes, there is a problem, Stephen. Absolutely. And we would have to deal with that problem.
How would you deal with it? You can't walk out again?
Well, we would have to then seek a resolution to that problem. And there are new mechanisms that enable us to do that. There are new procedures that require the UK government to engage with the Northern Ireland executive to deal with any of those issues.
Engage with them.
Stephen,
The decision is not in Northern Ireland.
And to resolve those issues. But Stephen, the UK government has a veto, which was not in the protocol. Stormont now has a say in the laws that apply to Northern Ireland. That was my mandate, Stephen. Read the seven tests. That's precisely what the seven tests said. I have delivered that. I have delivered a veto for the UK government. I've delivered a say for the people of Northern Ireland. That's what I set out to do. That is what I have achieved.
Well, obviously, Sir Geoffrey Donaldson is no longer the leader of the DUP, but that was the DUP's collective sell to people. And if you listen back to that, you will hear them say, "We have cut the pipeline." Listening to that is the leader of the TUV, Jim Allister. Have we cut the pipeline in your view?
Sadly and absolutely not, because we wouldn't be having a discussion about how you stop EU law if the pipeline had been cut. It's quite clear that EU law in 300 areas has supremacy in Northern Ireland, and all the Stormont Brake does, and we'll soon know as a consequence of it being tested, is allows 30 members of the Assembly to ask the government to consider the law that's been brought in, to have discussions with the EU, and yes, ultimately, if they had the courage to do it, to exercise an effective veto. But it certainly does not give the Assembly the right to stop EU law. EU law flows automatically through that pipeline into effect.
Not according to the DUP. Listen to that interview. EU law no longer automatically applies in Northern Ireland. That's what the DUP told the people.
And in that, they were misleading the people, because that is not correct. And the very fact that it's now a Stormont Brake which has to be applied demonstrates that the Assembly itself does not have the power to decide the laws that apply to it in this area. And all they can do is say, "Please, sir, would you ever mind stopping the application of this law?" They cannot themselves stop it. But I'm interested in and supportive of the deployment of the Stormont Brake, because I want to know, as the people of Northern Ireland want to know, whether the sales pitch that went with it stands up. And we will soon, we will know in the next few months whether or not the application in this specific incident is of any value whatsoever. But this is the point. If it proves to be of no value, then what does the DUP do then? Because having told us that they'd cut the pipeline, having told us they devised a mechanism that could stop EU law, if it proves they can't and this storm bit does not work, then what do they do? Do they simply return to being colonial implementers of foreign law? Or do they take a stand and say this is an assembly which, when it can be overridden by a foreign jurisdiction, is an assembly not worth having in those circumstances?
Your problem here in all of this is a fundamental one, which is you fight every day for Northern Ireland to remain in the UK and therefore ultimately to be at the control of Westminster. You don't want Stormont. You want Westminster to have supremacy. And your problem here, your fundamental problem, Jim, is there's absolutely no doubt that Parliament can stop this EU law. Your problem is you don't think Parliament will. So on the one hand, you fight every day for Northern Ireland to be under the authority of Parliament, and yet now you know you're in trouble.
No, Stephen, what I fight for every day is for the United Kingdom to reclaim sovereignty over all its territory. It surrendered in 300 years of sovereignty to a foreign parliament. I want that recovered. Now, the issue we're talking about is an evolved issue. So in the devolution arrangement, the decision on this matter should be made in Stormont, not in Westminster.
So you do believe in Stormont?
I believe in a Stormont that works, but I don't believe in a Stormont which is a colonial outpost for the EU, where it has to, in subservience, implement laws that other electors, those who are elected by others, make, namely in 27 other countries. And that's the kernel of the issue here. We are being subjected to a law not made in Westminster, not made in Stormont, made in a foreign parliament. By not,
and
none
it's up
of
to the sovereign parliament that you believe in the House of Commons, to decide whether they are going to accept that or not.
It's up to the government whether they will take heed of the expression of opposition by over 30 MLAs to this colonial rule from Brussels. And if they do, then they have the capacity to stop it ultimately. That's a protracted process. If they don't, then it will be a roughshod put upon the people of Northern Ireland. And that's why I come back to the point. If the Stormbreak fails to be ineffective and useless in that regard, then what's the DUP going to do then? That's the real question, which ultimately will arise out of the application of the summer break.
Well, what do you want?
We'll soon see whether it lives up to Geoffrey Donaldson's salesmanship. I have little doubt it won't. But, you know, we all heard there what Geoffrey oversold in that regard. And now is a moment of truth as to whether or not the summer break amounts to what he claimed it amounts and cuts the pipeline. I don't believe it does, but we'll soon know.
What do you expect the DUP to do? If Parliament, if the House of Commons, if that democratic process within all of the MPs, if the government of the day decides, do you know what? No, it's okay.
Well, I expect the DUP to deliver what they told the people of Northern Ireland had delivered, namely that the pipeline of EU law had been cut, that EU law could not be imposed upon us. If they fail in this, then it will be imposed upon us. And then they have a challenge. Well, having misled the people into believing it wouldn't happen, it now has happened. Are we going to be the serfs of Stormont who simply implement foreign jurisdiction? Or are we going to stand up and say, no, you will not do this to us. We will not do it to ourselves, rather. And we will not implement a system whereby we do not control, cannot change, cannot make the laws that apply to us.
But what does that mean? What literally are you asking the DUP to do? Do what?
Well, I believe the DUP surrendered the fundamental leverage they have by going back into Stormont. I think last week's vote in Stormont would have been very different. If the question really had been, do you want Stormont back? If you do, then you must vote down the protocol. But instead, it was unionism that was on the back foot. And I believe that if we are put in a position where it's demonstrably clear that we are the serfs of Stormont, implementing foreign EU jurisdiction with no right to stop it and no capacity to stop it, then the DUP has to answer the question, are they prepared to be those serfs, or is Stormont then not worth the candle that is suggested?
So what you're essentially saying, Jim, finally, is that the DUP should not have gone back into Stormont.
Yes, that's right.
There's no doubt that's what you're saying. And yet over recent months, look at least the accountability mechanism that there has been for people in this country because there is Stormont.
Sure.
With the likes of John O'Dowd now being challenged as a local minister about the traffic chaos in Belfast, about Gordon Lyons being
the Greenleaf
minister being challenged, Paul Given, the education minister, being able to make local decisions and decide where money does and does not go, and being challenged about it. Look at that local accountability.
Yeah. Yes, yes, it's wonderful. Traffic chaos in Belfast, crony appointments from education, and nothing changes at all. You know, who in the right mind thinks Stormont has brought good, stable, dependable government? My goodness, you only have to look at how my MLA on the executive committee is shut down at every opportunity by the executive party. So there isn't challenge. I think anyone who thinks...
I don't think anybody could say, to be fair to Timothy Gaston, that he hasn't been able to challenge. Yes, he has.
Well, he certainly has been able to challenge, and it's due to his strength.
Are you writing the lines for him? Are you writing the script for him, or is it himself?
It's certainly very much himself. It is.
So you have no input into it?
I have no input into it. Timothy is there to represent the TUV. I represent the TUV in Parliament, and we both, I think, do a reasonable job.
Okay. Jim Alistair, thank you very much indeed. Happy Christmas, Mr. Alistair.
And to you, Mr. Nolan.
And a happy new year.
Indeed.
I keep on searching the office and I do not see a Christmas card from the TUV.
Did you not get the big box?
I keep on searching through the paperwork and there's no Christmas card.
Just abide in patience, Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Alistair.
Thank you.
Mr. Butler, the deputy leader of the Ulster Unionist Party, is with us this morning. Good morning to you, Robbie.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. I see no Christmas card from you either, but that's another matter. is this a story this morning about the labelling of chemicals? It's a lot of money. It's £1 billion worth of chemicals. That's what it's worth to the Northern Ireland economy. Or is this a story about whether any of you have any actual power? You can have a say in what happens, but it's up to the UK government whether they listen to you or not. Is that power?
It's absolutely not. It's an interesting one because it is multi-layered. There is the fiscal impact of the which has been picked up in the impact assessments, by the way, which the Windsor Framework Democratic Scrutiny Committee actually got. And from their own department. So I think it was the Department of the Economy, perhaps, supplied evidence that would show the cost in terms of trade. But we've also got, as you listened to Jim, the future divergence of between Northern Ireland and GB. The Windsor Framework picked out just over 300 articles. And then when we get these moments, this is about the ambition of Stormont and its politicians to either put Northern Ireland first and to look at the assessment of the impact on us, or whether you want to slavishly follow just the EU diktat, and that wouldn't be the ambition of any unionist politician.
So the DUP, and look, it wasn't just Sir Geoffrey Donaldson. Sir Geoffrey Donaldson was speaking on behalf of the party, which had agreed telling the people of Northern Ireland that they had cut the pipeline of EU law. Can you help me understand, Robbie, how the pipeline has already been cut if unionists are now essentially asking the British government to stop this piece of EU law? How's the pipeline been automatically cut?
Well, I would. If your assessment is that it hasn't been cut, I would agree with you. And I listened into the debate, which I listened to last year, and it's something that we've been warning about since 2016. And I'm not saying that to grandstand, but the reality is that the Stormont break is a mechanism, but it falls far short of delivering tangible leverage here, either with the Westminster government or indeed the EU, because as has been pointed out, it is right to use the tools that you have. But unfortunately, when we did the analysis of the Stormont break, the analysis pointed out that we Northern Ireland could end up in the worst of all worlds, because if we were to win the argument, for instance, on this, and it was even accepted, there is the possibility, albeit small, that Northern Ireland could find itself in a place where it doesn't comply with either EU or GB regulation. So, for instance, if GB didn't went to change their regulations and we were left with the old regulation, we would be in the worst of all worlds. But what this does require, and hopefully what will happen, is that the new Labour government will see that this is an impact in Northern Ireland, that they don't want to have the ambition for future divergence and increased divergence, and that they want the UK to align in its internal market, which should be our ambition because it's our greatest and biggest trading opportunity. And then they would see the change and get that message from unionism.
Let me ask about this big bad word then. Big bad word in your view, divergence.
Yeah.
And let's then apply some common sense to the question around it. So you believe in devolution. You believe in local ministers, local political parties deciding on behalf of the people of Northern Ireland how the laws should be here, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is divergence. So how can you, on the one hand, be worried that divergence will threaten the union, and yet the very point of Stormont is to decide upon when divergence is appropriate to Northern Ireland? There's a complete contradiction at the heart of this.
But there absolutely isn't. And the reason that there isn't is because we have MPs in London. So in all of those laws that you are talking about, Stephen, we either have MLAs here on the devolved matters, and then on the matters that aren't devolved, we have MPs. Most of them take their seats. And Robin Swan, to be fair to him, is punching well above his weight. He's doing very, very well. And therefore, in those senses, we don't have divergence. Where we do have divergence is in the laws that are created at the EU. And if we don't assess them as they come through, and these are new and amended.
There's still divergence, right? Every time Stormont makes a decision, it's divergence. So divergence doesn't threaten the union when it suits unionists.
But this isn't just based on the divergence. So when you look at the impact assessments which have been provided by our own department, and actually paragraph 41 of this pact that committee had, where it says the legal opinion was that it would be future divergence. Well, all of these items of divergence, if they affect trade, which they do, and that's been measurably so, well, then that is not good for the health of Northern Ireland and its economy. So it shouldn't be the ambition for anybody to utilise future divergence, which causes instability, whether that's trade, whether that's increased cost. And Stephen, even in the assessment of the EU for changing these regulations, they indicate tens of millions of pounds of additional costs which are passed on to the stakeholders. And ultimately, that is to the customers for no discernible benefit, because this is moving away from a UN regulation. GB, the Westminster government, have indicated that they have no ambition to move away from that. And really, it doesn't make sense. So the assessment here is this useful? Is this beneficial to Northern Ireland in terms of trade opportunities? Well, no, it's not. Is future divergence from UK law good for Northern Ireland and for everybody in Northern Ireland? Well, no, it's not. And what's interesting is that in the committee inquiry, they never determined that actually it was beneficial to Northern Ireland. They actually couldn't make up their mind in paragraph 44. So instead of at the point of not being able to make up their mind, saying, well, let's have a further look at this, let's investigate this further, the numbers on the committee said, there probably is a problem there, and the legal advice is telling us that there's a problem, but we'll bury our heads in the sand and hope it'll go away. That can't be the case.
I know you need to go, but just before you do so, so when we then look at a separate story about Stormont, so the executive has agreed the draft budget for next year, for the 25-26 financial year. And it's so important that budget, isn't it? How the amount of money that our government in Northern Ireland has, how it's going to divvy it up, what impact it's going to have, on children, on households, on pensioners, on our roads. It's that important, Robbie.
Yeah.
And we hear yesterday it being announced that it's going out for consultation. What, 3 days before Christmas?
Yeah. But, Stephen, this time last year, most of us would have been up in Hillsborough trying to make the argument for the case for increased investment in Northern Ireland, which was secured. But what we also inherited was 5 years out of eight of no leadership, no government, and minimal transformation, because the transformation piece and actually making this place better comes from clear and ambitious political leadership. That's been by neglect, Northern Ireland has suffered in public services in particular. So it's been hard work for just about every department. And I listened to a couple of the ministers' responses on this, and I mean, might give it a cautious welcome. But at the same time, the caveats are still there. For instance, there was no additional money to tackle waiting lists. And waiting lists are a significant priority. It's one of the things that MLAs hear about most in terms of the communication with constituents. So there are still gaps that we need to address. With a bit of stability in government and a bit of longevity, perhaps we may see those changes.
Okay. Robbie, thank you for being with us this morning. Robbie Butler from the Ulster Unionist Party. I said 3 days before Christmas, the 20th, just in case I shock you into racing out for the Christmas shopping you haven't done yet, if you're anything like me. 03030 80 55 55. Peter's in Banbridge. Morning, Peter.
Hello, yes, Stephen. How are you doing?
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say something that Jim Allister said there, but first, I just want to tell the DUP today, they've got Brexit. They voted for Brexit, so now they've got it. So that's that point settled.
Well, they would tell you they didn't get the Brexit that people voted for.
Well, that's what we voted for here. But no, and Jim Allister says all this about colonial rule. I've got a bit of news for Jim. We've been under colonial rule and subject to foreign law for 850 years. So it's nothing new to people in Ireland that we have colonial rule or foreign laws in Northern Ireland or Ireland's 32 counties, 4 provinces. That's a wee bit of information for Jim Allister for the new year.
Peter, thank you. Happy Christmas to you. Gareth and Kirkcubbin. Morning, Gareth.
Morning, Stephen. I listened to Steve Aitken this morning on Good Morning Ulster, and then I listened to the commentary afterwards. And what it was effectively doing was walking us back to the UK backstop. It was walking us back to Theresa May, because this is a good case study for unionism at the moment. They've waited until they could find a good case study in terms of how much money it's worth in terms of divergence. But there's one flaw in it, and that is that the EU standards are higher than the UN standards. They thought they had clinched it because it involved a third party. It involved the United Nations. But they cannot try and achieve a positive, because less diversion for unionism is a positive.
The story surely also is this Stormont break actually effective in stopping anything? The story also is, it doesn't matter that the DUP is led by a different person now. The DUP told the people of Northern Ireland the pipeline of automatic EU law was cut.
But there's another question.
So how,
Stephen,
is it cut if they're now trying to stop it?
There's another
how
question,
is it cut?
Stephen. There's another question.
Now, Gavin Stephen. Robinson then, of why, course, why, talked about would, cautious... What was it that they were...
Why,
cautious
why would
what?
People,
cautious
why would people
realism.
The,
what does that
why
mean?
Would people, why would people in the Assembly vote for worse standards with chemical labelling? Because that's what unionism's saying, that we would rather have worse standards. That's what Theresa May said as well. She said that businesses...
I don't think unionists are saying that. I think unionists are saying
they want the
unionists in Northern Ireland are saying they want the same standards that are applicable
in
Great Britain and the rest of the UK.
Why aren't they lobbying GB? Because Theresa May said businesses would not want to have worse standards anyway. And that's why she came up with the common rule book.
Right at the start. You're very animated in the run-up to Christmas. I was sitting last night surrounded with sweets, so many of them that they were melting on the sofa. I actually lay on a couple. I have to dig them out of the sofa now. I had my wee slippers on. I'm in Christmas mood. You're very animated, Gareth, but thank you for calling us. Happy Christmas. We'll pause there and we'll get the news from the BBC. So you're hearing that the executive has agreed a draft budget for the 25-26 financial year. The Health Minister Mike Nesbitt described the budget as very challenging allocation with room for improvement. Anne Watt, director of the independent think tank Pivotal, with us next this morning. Morning, Anne.
Good morning, Stephen.
So this now goes out to consultation. What does that actually result in? What's that mean?
So there's 12 weeks where people can respond to the draft budget, so they can look at the numbers and then go back to the executive and say they think that there's not enough money in there for, you know, maybe health waiting lists, or there should be more given to the police, or there should be more on our transport system. So it's a chance for people out there, whether they're experts in a particular area or members of the public or people involved in delivering public services, and they can say, this is how we think this is good and right and along the right lines, or here's how it needs to change. So that's a 12-week period. And I think it's important to say, Stephen, we have not had a proper consultation like that on the budget for 4 years. The last time it happened was January 2021. So this is a good opportunity to increase the transparency about the process, about what money
is it a good opportunity, though?
Scrutiny.
Is it an opportunity for the politicians to battle it out? But does government actually really care what a white van man, a plumber, a hairdresser, anybody thinks?
Yeah,
they'll just make the decisions themselves.
Yeah, the question is how much will actually change. You know, you could look at what happens, you know, with the final budget and compare it to this one and see how have they responded to the comments that have been made. So I think it is important that the executive will want to hear what people think about this. They'll particularly want to hear what, say, people involved in delivering public services think about it. They'll particularly want to hear what the voluntary sector think about it, what experts think about it, what people who have knowledge of public finances think about it. The other thing that will happen in the next 12 weeks is there will be more information released from departments. So yesterday's data is headlines, and you know I've had a good look at it, but I've still got loads of questions. So there'll be more information coming from each department saying in more detail what they're going to spend on, and that will be scrutinised as well through the committees at Stormont. So there'll be politicians looking at this, but also it's open to anyone.
What are the pinch points, do you think? What are the big areas for controversy, for disagreement, that will be battled out?
Yeah, I mean, this, nobody's saying this, but this budget is slightly more flexible than what we've had in recent years. It's a bit less tight because there was a big injection of money in the UK's budget in October. So you'll remember, and you've talked about how employer national insurance went up. That raised $25 billion. That was then divided up across public services, and Northern Ireland gets an extra chunk of money because of that. So there's an injection of new funding into this budget. So it is less tight than it has been in recent years, which is why, you know, I know there was some challenge yesterday from politicians, but generally there was more agreement around the executive table than there has been in the last few years about budgets. So there's a bit more flexibility. I think the big questions are, is this budget going to result in a depth change improvement in our challenging areas, the most challenging things that we have? You know, is this budget going to result in addressing waiting lists, for example? Is it going to result in improvements in traffic congestion and public transport? Is it going to result in being able to get a GP appointment? Is it going to be easier for people to get a special educational need place for their child? Are police budgets going to be less stretched? Are those things going to really improve, or is it just going to be more of the same? And I think the challenge for the executive is to be much more ambitious about what they're doing and to set themselves longer term plans and to start taking the first steps in those directions to really make a difference, not just to do more of the same, not just to kind of keep going along with where we are at the minute, because where we are at the minute isn't satisfactory in a whole load of different ways, whether it's the health service or in education or the environment or childcare. It's not satisfactory and it really does need to improve.
Okay, and well, thank you very much indeed. Morning to you, 030 30 80 55 55. Let's come back then to what you'll be hearing about in the news, the Stormont break and these EU laws around labelling of chemicals. Coming to you, Alex Kane, editor Sligo Tool McFeely with us this morning. Morning, Alex.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mick.
Hi, Stephen.
Good morning. So is this a test, Mick, as to what the Stormont break is, how effective it is, whether it's worth talking about much?
Yeah, no, I think it is. It's the first test, and there's a legitimate case, I think, to answer on this, or for it to be tested. Now, the tests for the Stormont break, whether it has an effect or not, quite tough. It's only to be used in the most exceptional circumstances. And it has to be, and this is significant, has to be preceded by substantive discussions with the UK government, because ultimately it's the UK government and the EU that sit on the joint committee, and that's the body that is set up to manage relations. You know, if we all thought Brexit was over, no. Brexit is a long-term gig, and this is part of that. This is part of managing the tensions of the settlement that we got. But the scope of the change has to really have a significant impact specific to everyday life of communities in Northern Ireland in a way that's likely to persist. And there is a prima facie case in the case of labelling that may well be so, but it has several tests then that it's got to, it has to prove that case without beyond dispute, that this isn't simply the pharmaceutical industry basically saying, well, you know, well, it's going to push our costs up and this is going to have a negative impact.
And
you'd expect a lobby group to say that sort of thing, but this is hopefully this will face a stiffer test through the process.
But whether it proves all that or not, Alex Keane has, as the DUP said, has EU law automatically applying to Northern Ireland, has that pipeline been cut?
No, it hasn't been cut, Stephen. And if you look back to the command paper, which is the paper that brought the DUP over the line back into the executive and assembly, it was quite clear. I mean, if you listen to what Donaldson said in your interview and what other DUP people said at the time and since then, that's the whole point. If all these problems had been resolved, I think somebody mentioned it earlier, if the pipeline had been blocked or closed down, whatever it was, there would be no need for the storm and break. But the problem is, if you look at this, Stephen, you go back to Theresa May's, I think Gareth mentioned her, Theresa May's original backstop proposal, that wasn't good enough for the DUP. The alternative to that, the Northern Ireland Protocol, wasn't good enough for the DUP. The winter framework wasn't good enough for the DUP. It looks like this command paper is not going to be strong enough. I'm simply saying, as a matter of history, Stephen, if the DUP are expecting the British government to ride to the rescue in this particular thing, I think that's a huge ask, because there's been no evidence. It's quite clear. Keir Starmer, he has enough other problems on his desk right now, Stephen. He does not want to start some sort of battle with the DUP over this. And I think, I don't know how you fully resolve the union thing, because it's not just about the labelling. And psychologically, Stephen, it's not just about the labelling of these goods. It's not just about the divergence and so on. It's the fact that unionism, all of it, I mean, you were talking to Robbie earlier and so on, and Jim, and the DUP view as well, is that what these laws are doing. I mean, we've always talked about the divergence, Northern Ireland being a place apart, but Northern Ireland was always a place apart and diverged entirely within the United Kingdom. This position the unionism finds itself in now is that the laws, while yes, it may be diverging, it's not diverging because it's taking laws unto itself, granted to it by the sovereign parliament of the United Kingdom. It is also, unions would argue, having to take laws from another authority, which is placing Northern Ireland in this weird position. It's neither quite fully in the UK, nor fully in the
EU. But I'm sorry, Alex. I know I'm sounding repetitive this morning, but it is not a small matter that the biggest unionist party in Northern Ireland assured the people of Northern Ireland that the automatic pipeline of EU law had been cut. So they looked the people straight in the eye, and that's what they told them.
Well, I talked to you in this programme about that time. I certainly wrote a couple of articles about it. And I said, my understanding of the command paper, that it was very top-heavy on promises from the government that they would look at something, they would think about it, they would sort of wriggle around it. You know, if unions had trouble, they'd do their best to do it. But it's what I said earlier. Every other time the government has said, we'll address unions, they failed to do so. So my concern back then with that command paper, there was nothing concrete, Stephen. It was all maybe. And because it was ambiguous, Stephen, then the DUP clearly misled people when they said that they had stopped it, because they hadn't stopped it. And again, that's why they needed the storm and break in place.
The DUP leader, Gavin Robinson, was on Evening Extra last night. It was put to him that critics from the outset said the storm and break was no veto and offered no protection. Gavin was asked if he was about to test that now and see what kind of reaction he gets from the London government.
Unionists like me have always recognised that the sovereign power on these issues rests with our sovereign parliament and our government. But this proposal, the storm and break, the system that we now have, is there as an opportunity that not only places a legal obligation on the government when exercising their decisions to take account of the views of the Northern Ireland Assembly, it injects scrutiny and a role for our democratically elected politicians that just simply did not exist. And whilst you will have some who you've referred to who have been dismissive of the whole notion of the creation of this democratic scrutiny mechanism, you've had others on the other side of the coin who have tried to structure their concerns so robustly that this wouldn't create divergence, it would create trivergence indeed, and how difficult that would be for Northern Ireland. So whilst you have some on the extremes of the arguments on either side, I think this is an appropriate and an important opportunity for Stormont and the Assembly to have the maturity to discuss the issue itself the impact of the issue on industry and on the people of Northern Ireland, and the mechanisms that were created to inject democratic involvement, scrutiny and accountability.
But Gavin, your party did not just say, did they? You did not just say at the time that this was about scrutiny. You didn't do that. Your party told the people of Northern Ireland that the pipeline of EU law automatically applying to Northern Ireland had been cut. So if it had automatically been cut, how now are you objecting to these laws? How are the laws in place? How are you objecting to them? That you've got to try to stop them? McFeely, can you help me understand that?
Well, I'm not sure I can help you personally understand it. Look, I found the logic of what Gavin just said there absolutely, completely understandable. He's calling for a mature reflection on the actual issues here. There is no automatic right to stop laws from the EU.
We have cut the pipeline, quote DUP.
Well, what all that means, and look, you know, at the end of the day, we can interpret it differently, but for me, all that means is they have the right to launch an objection at Stormont. And one of the details of the way the break works is once that's been launched by 30 MLAs, which is the same as the cross community matter of petition of concern. What it takes a much larger majority to undo it, so to speak. So this is something that was a serious opportunity for Stormont to disrupt the process. And in that sense, I would understand the term, block the pipeline of automatic, automated.
EU law no longer automatically applies in Northern Ireland. That's what the DUP said. Is it true?
Well, it is true in the sense that this is an opportunity. It's not a right. As Gavin rightly points out, the sovereign parliament is in Westminster, not in Stormont. Stormont is a devolved power from Westminster, so it doesn't have an automatic right, but it has an opportunity where it can flag genuine distress and disruption for the life of communities, that it has that right to do so. And in that sense, yes, this is a cutting of automatic pipeline. It's not, it's discretionary. Most regulation comes through because it's uncontroversial. And the only reason this is being raised is because the pharmaceutical industry has flagged this as something with potential negativity. And I think, look, that what we're losing sight of here is, in all of this talk about principle, and I understand where that talk is coming from, this is about what opportunities are available to us. It's about access, and it's about access two ways. And Northern Ireland's doing rather well out of this access to the EU that the rest of the United Kingdom doesn't have. But that comes with this extra obligation to make sure that you maintain your access to those European markets. It's a remarkable privilege that Northern Ireland has. And the Stormont break is to make sure that there is no countervailing blocks that arise between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. It's perfectly legitimate for it to happen like this, and this will, as you rightly suggested, this will be a test of not simply does the mechanism work, but whether our politicians in Stormont have the maturity to talk this one out, to talk it through, and to carry their case to Westminster. Because if it's a weak case, it will get knocked to the boundary without any hesitation.
McFeely, thank you. Alex Kane, thank you very much indeed. So let's see what Sir Keir Starmer's administration dolls about this. When concerns from the unionist community, let's not forget here about those people within the nationalist community, within other communities in Northern Ireland who have no problem with this whatsoever. I mentioned Sir Keir Starmer. I see today that Robert Peston from ITV is saying that he is shocked at the number of people within the Labour Party who are saying they doubt Sir Keir Starmer will be the leader of the Labour Party going into the next election. And that's interesting in itself. We've been talking about roads and traffic, as you know, for many, many days, many weeks now in the Nolan Show. And cyclists and cycle lanes has prompted Philip, who's been listening to us, to get in touch. Morning to you, Philip.
Good morning, Stephen. Thanks for inviting me on.
No problem. Happy Christmas to you. I'm in Christmas mood. I've got my Christmas socks on.
I was in the Christmas mood, but...
what's happened to you?
Unfortunately, my the situation has come to a pass now where, with the increased traffic volumes, and now you're discussing taxis on bus lanes, cyclists are almost fighting for position on the roads. It's got to the point, I had four or five close encounters over the last 2 weeks, and then finally my luck ran out on Wednesday on the A24 Belfast bound by Forestside, where two lanes become three when you're turning in from Hampton Park and Annandale. And I always take the second lane to prepare to be in the middle position perfectly away from cars, vans, trucks. And a van abruptly, well, impatiently behind a bus, pulled out right in front of me, which gave me no time to react, no time to brake, no time to swerve, no time to react. And the next thing I know, I'm lying on the ground.
Oh, my goodness. It hit you, did it?
Yes, it hit me.
His door hit you, or what? Did the car hit you?
The van hit me.
Oh, for goodness sake.
He didn't look. He was an R-plater. And this is my whole emphasis on education, investment, and serious thought between Stormont and the Department for Infrastructure, because cyclists need a designated cycle lane.
So what happened? Was he... Like a van hitting anybody, are you all right? That's what I'm asking.
Well, I'm bruised and battered. hand is swollen. Very lucky. Fortunately, I wear luminous gear. I have flashing lights. You know, you can't miss me. I'm literally so brightly coloured with reflectors on spokes, brightly coloured outfits and flashing lights. It literally was a case of a driver getting fed up, being stuck behind a bus and swerved out. And I had no reaction time.
Did he stop?
Yes, he did. Him and another vehicle behind him stopped. He was shocked that he hit me. He said he didn't see me, which was what I always have to endure when people say, oh, I didn't see you, I didn't see you. The amount of times I've had near misses on the Ormer Road and Sainfield Road. And this is the crux of the situation. When you have a bus lane, you have the largest and heaviest vehicle against the lightest, smallest bicycle. Bus lanes are not fit for purpose for cyclists. Now, this isn't a motorist against cyclist argument. I'm a mad F1 fan. I drive a car, I ride motorbikes, and I ride cycles into work because I need to keep my exercise up. But the government, or the Stormont and the Department of Infrastructure, need cycle lanes now. Ever since the global impasse, you've had the situ of more people getting on their bikes, getting out there, keeping fit. Cars, buses, every type of commercial vehicle, no one has time for you. No one has space for you. I've had buses rub up against my shoulder on the roads. I've had people gesticulating, shouting, screaming, revving, literally near me all the time. One of my friends was on the road going past Stormont, going past Forestside, and I said, Richard, what are you doing on the road? I'm on the pavement going uphill northward here because it's too dangerous. I'll be brave. I've been brave for far too long and things have got to change.
So are you confident to use your bike again?
No.
Given the near miss you've had.
This morning, my wife basically said, that's enough. Enough is enough. You've had so many near misses. You can't use the bike. You're going to have to go to a gym and use a bike if that's what you want to do.
Like, the bottom line is, this wasn't a miss. You were on the ground. You'd been hit.
Yeah, I've had near misses, but this was the final straw for her as well. She'd had enough of this and said, that's it. You know, people are not educated here. And I've lived here 27 years. So, and I've been cycling the same route for 4 years solid, 4 days a week.
So is it about the infrastructure, the lack of continuous bus cycle lanes?
Yes.
Or is it a lack of education? You know, you're putting it down to people not knowing how to drive besides cyclists. Is that what you're saying?
I think they're frustrated around cyclists. They see cyclists as an annoyance because, you know, we are only able to go a certain speed. The road I use between Saints...
Is it not all right? Sorry to cut across you, but is it not all right to be frustrated? It's what you do when you're frustrated.
Yes.
If you're travelling in a car,
yep,
and there's a cyclist doing a couple of miles an hour, and you can do 30 in that car and you can't get round them, I'm not too sure it's unnatural to not get slightly frustrated. It's what you do, surely.
Yeah, well, cyclists well know that we are supposed to be given a metre and a half space by all traffic around us at any given moment. That simply is not happening. Even the bus drivers that have the signs on the back of their buses allowing 1.5 metres width don't adhere to their own messaging on the bus.
So what are you saying then in terms of this two-way relationship between motorists and cyclists, Philip? When you see on the roads, this is a different discussion from the one you've just been having.
Yeah.
But when you see cyclists on a road and there are three of them and they're deliberately taking up the whole line and there's a car behind them, sitting behind them, going along a country road or any other road at whatever, 2-3 mile an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Is that good cycling? Should they pull in to single lane? To one cycle at a time so the car can get round them? Is that dangerous? Is that rude? What's your view as a cyclist?
I think at the end of the day, when you have three cyclists taking one lane, they're protecting themselves. They have every right to be on the road as a car driver. I'm both. I'm a car driver. I'm even a motorcycle rider and a cyclist. I see both points of view, but ultimately it's about safety.
But is there anything unsafe about them pulling in so that it's one cycle at the side of the road travelling along? Rather, is it a safety reason that they're travelling in threes and fours, taking up the whole lane?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. There's always an argument for and against, which you pointed out. But if you've got three cyclists in one lane, cars, buses and vans will naturally adhere to the next lane to overtake them. If you have one cyclist, like myself, cars have a tendency to take 1.5 lanes.
Okay.
They don't physically come out of the lane they're in. They cut you up.
I'm glad you're okay. And thank you for bringing this story to us today. And happy Christmas to you. Here comes the news at 10. Happy Christmas, everyone. And I hope you have a peaceful new year as well. This is my last show for 2024. Of course, the Nolan Show will be continuing full flight on Monday and Tuesday of next week. Business class flights next. Stormont ministers have spent $35,000 on business class flights since devolution was restored in February. Gordon Lyons, Conor Murphy, Paul Given getting business class flights. Well, what do you want them to do? Get on a bike? Go into economy? Some of you do want them to go into economy. Is it really that big a deal that government ministers travelling on business, they're not going on holiday, they're working for the country, are getting a business class flight? Well, I guess that's the debate. Jerry Carroll certainly thinks it's an issue. People Before Profit, MLA, says the spending is out of touch with ordinary people.
Well, I don't think it should be one rule for ministers and another rule for everybody else. And if ministers want to upgrade the business class, they should pay it out of their own pockets, not out of the pockets of the public purse. There's still massive questions over a lot of these meetings and appointments and visits in the US in particular. There's still a massive question over what is the outcome, what is the productivity of these meetings, and in many cases, the most of them are just talking chaps. Some of this stuff can be done virtually, some of this can be done through other forms of communication. And I think in most cases, there's no purpose or need for these visits, just for really to satisfy the ministers.
We'll talk about this with some guests this morning. Before we do so, you, 030-30-80-55-55. Brian, what do you think?
Morning, Stephen. Happy Christmas to you.
Happy Christmas.
I think that in a time where, as Gerry has just pointed out, I mean, I think in business, Stephen, you look for efficiency. And I expect the same from our politicians. In relation to the travel expenses, I don't believe, really, from what I have seen as an experienced business owner of 40 years, I don't see MLAs and local MPs able to spend our money wisely. So until I would see that, I would expect them to fly in standard economy class as opposed to business class. In other words, when I would feel as an individual that my massive rates bills and tax bills, etc., were being used wisely, then I would say, okay, to the likes of Conor Murphy, you can go and fly business class. For example, speaking of Conor Murphy, look at the disgusting amounts of money that was hemorrhaged with the sports inverted commas grants. 70 grand here, half a million there. So I would say to these MLAs, they get so used to spending our money, Stephen, it's almost invisible. And I can prove it to you. You mentioned one of the DUP ministers there a short while ago. He claimed he didn't know that 40-odd grand had been spent until he got back and took a look at the figures. I think that was because the Telegraph newspaper decided to highlight the issue in the first place, and I thought it was an extremely incompetent answer. So I think my point simply is this. When this place is running well, we have health waiting lists well down the block, and our schools and our infrastructure is going well, then I will say, as a company perk, you've done good, so you can have that as a perk. That's my answer to it.
Bran, thank you very much. Paul Gosling, the economist, journalist. Morning, Paul.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, and commentator Erwin Armstrong. Morning to you, Erwin.
Good morning, Stephen. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas. Happy, happy Christmas. Look, Paul, there should at least be a discussion around, do we really want to treat our politicians with such tight reins that people who we need to attract into politics think that they're going to be constantly criticised no matter what they do? There's a difference between accountability, surely, and, you know, you're in the headlines for what? You get a business class seat? Now, others will say they can only travel economy, so why should a government minister not set the example and travel like most people do? Where do you stand on this?
Broadly, I'm not that far away from what Jerry Carroll was saying. I think there is a sense of entitlement amongst some of the ministers, and they feel that actually their status means that they should fly business class. But I think we do have to take it on a case-by-case basis. And if there is a situation where someone has a long-haul flight and they're going straight into a business meeting from the plane, then yes, that can be justified. But even then, we had a situation a few weeks ago where one of the officials had a business class flight paid for at £5,000 return to the US. And clearly that was a failure of the procurement processes. And so even if you have a situation where...
Yeah, but that's a different discussion, isn't it? There's a different discussion.
Well, it is a connected discussion, isn't it, Stephen? So, you know, it's not simply about whether ministers and officials are being paid for to go business class. It's also whether we're getting best value for money for the flights themselves.
No, look, it's a valid discussion, but it's a separate one from the principle of... Should, no matter what the price, no matter how good a sales seat you get on business class... I travel back and forward to the States maybe 5 or 6 times a year. I've never paid more than £1,400 each for a business class seat. You just watch the sales. If you go from Dublin, you pay less tax, and that's the bottom line. So a £5,000 business class seat, absolutely up for discussion, Paul. But I guess, yep, I'm trying to have a different discussion today, which is this. In many other walks of life, when you're trying to attract the really top people, many other businesses give perks. So they give the people they're trying to attract, whether it's a package of incentives that includes good medical insurance, it includes a nice car, and all of that. And many businesses will give their employees business class travel. That's why business class exists. Should we really be putting the squeeze on politicians to the extent where if you've got someone that's maybe contemplating leaving the private sector, that they just think to themselves, no, I'm not going to do it. Why would I?
Yeah, I take your point, Stephen, but I think perhaps you're focusing on the wrong thing in talking about business class flights. I mean, actually, in order to become a minister, you first become an MLA. And actually, I know this is an unpopular thing to say, but MLA salaries are not realistic. They're about 50,000 plus. And that's actually not enough to attract in high quality people with experience into being MLAs. So that's the first thing you need to do if you're going to attract higher quality ministers. You get higher quality MLAs. In terms of the business class flights, no, I don't think it's justified. I think if they're going straight into an important meeting off the plane, then yes, but it has to be a case-by-case basis. The idea that you need, in order to fly to Faro in Portugal, to go business class, I think that's just a bit of a joke, to be honest.
Erwin?
Well, I think you need to look at the actual business class, because there's long haul and there's short haul. There is no excuse for traveling business class and short haul. And by short haul, I would talk about up to 4 hours. I think there is definitely a case if you're flying across the Atlantic and you're going to China for business class, because you will well know, Stephen, what jet lag does to you and time differences and everything. And if you can get some rest and sleep on the plane, it makes an enormous difference when you're traveling. And if you're going into important meetings, I think it should really only be for ministers.
Yeah, but there are lots of people on those flights every day to London. That are travelling to, you know, some of them would be construction workers who, you know, are out digging roads, and they must be tired. Some of them are equally going into important meetings, and they're not sitting in a business class seat.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. In short haul, there is no excuse for flying business class, because the seats are basically the same. You may have a space in the middle, but, there, you know, why do you pay maybe three times the price to sit in the front? And the other issue, which is one which you pointed out, which is if you actually shop around, you can go from, I think if you want to go to LA, for example, you can go from about £1,500 up to about £8,000. And as far as I'm aware, the civil service appoints a travel agent through a tendering process, and they give all of the bookings to them. And to me, that may not be getting you the best price. I don't know if our our ministers fly from Dublin, or if they go to London, is there some sort of embargo going to Dublin? I don't know why that's the case or not.
It's a really interesting point, actually. And look, I don't have the data in front of me, but Paul, as an economist, given the bulk buying that the Northern Ireland Civil Service must do in terms of the amount of flights they book, the amount of travel and hotels, surely to goodness they're getting a cheaper price than someone that flies to Mallorca once or twice a year. Surely they
are. Well,
they
should be. They should be. But actually, I know you don't particularly want to focus on procurement, Stephen, but just allow me to digress here.
I think it's an interesting conversation. Sure, no problem.
Yeah, it is the same conversation, really. The Northern Ireland Audit Office put out a report last year in which they were basically condemning the poor quality of procurement across the piece in the public sector in Northern Ireland. And they said that it was urgently needed for the Department of Finance to conduct a review of procurement and to publish it. Now, that's not been published yet. And you've got a situation where the auditors are saying that we're not getting effective value for money out of the vast amounts of money that is spent. And I think this is just one example that we're not actually getting the best value for money out of public spending in Northern Ireland.
Like, I give you, and this may sound farcical and it's undoable, I don't know, right? But when I'm flying back and forward to America, I've got an airline travel card that I pay a few hundred quid for a year. So I build up the air miles, and that allows us to travel for just over a grand. You use the air miles. Is the civil service doing things like that? Have politicians got these business credit cards where they're building up air miles and they could then travel on, paid for by the public, but the public getting advantage of the air miles? Is any of that going on, or is that too complicated, Paul?
it may well be too complicated, but and it why? May well be the AMA
opt-out
to being
accumulated
personally. Absolutely. But actually, what I can tell you, because I do have information on this, is that where Golden Lions and its officials went over to the US and Canada a few months ago, that the flights were organized at short notice. And because they were organized and confirmed at short notice, they were paying higher fees. Now, actually, you have to expect officials and ministers to arrange trips with a bit of advance notice, so they can actually then take the benefit of lower fees. If you're doing it at the last minute, though? You're going to be paying more.
But can you? So let's be fair again to Gordon. He's a busy minister. Surely
yeah, it's
goodness,
officials that organise it. No, yeah, but, it's officials that organise it.
But surely he's got to be able to have, you know, last minute bookings, for goodness sake.
Well, I think you're being a bit overgenerous there, Stephen. I think these things can be organised in a way that you take advantage of lower fees by having more effective advance negotiations and arrangements.
Brian,
I think the one thing you have to remember is sometimes when you're booking flights at short notes, you actually get cheaper prices because they want to fill the empty seats.
Tell you what, I don't see them. Yeah, but again, if I come back to my airlines, my Air Mile obsession, that's where you get. If there are seats available, they put the availability of those air miles on. I can't understand why it's not at least up for discussion, given the buying power that the civil service has, why politicians who are putting things on expenses, why they shouldn't be putting it on a civil service issued credit card and the public getting advantage of the free air miles that then come with that. Because at the minute, surely to goodness, what politicians are doing is they may get those credit cards for themselves. The public is then paying for their travel, and it's the politicians who are getting the air miles for their personal use. Surely to goodness, there's something in this. Is there not?
Oh, no, I think the other thing which I've often thought over many years is the size of the Northern Ireland Civil Service. Surely we could have a couple of travel experts employed who know the industry inside out and all the things you can do, instead of subcontracting it to an external travel agent to make all your arrangements. It seems to me to the ultimate sense with that volume of travel. And certainly you don't need to save very much to pay for somebody.
Erwin, thank you. Paul, thank you. Morning to you both. Brian's in Belfast. Morning, Brian.
Morning, Stephen. No, Stephen, what people object to is the minister's going on these long trips and a week or so, that has no advantage for the people of Northern Ireland. Now, if they're going on, I have certainly no objection if the minister's going to meetings on to help the economy here, bring jobs here, and going first class or business class, whatever you want to call it, for they have to check things, they have to read up. I know they read up before they go, but obviously they can catch up and be prepared for these important meetings. But, for instance, Mr. Lenz went on that trip with six people. And what I heard, I mean, I heard him talking about the actual trip and what he did. It was more of information. And I could have went on online and found out what I wanted to know.
Brian,
about
come on. Stuff. Listen, you know, some of you are going to accuse me of you know, protecting Gordon Lyons too much here. I don't know Gordon. I very rarely speak to me. He very rarely does an interview with me, although he has done, well, to be fair to him. But here's the score. You know, he's a minister in government, for goodness sake, and you want them doing everything down Zoom, do you?
He didn't listen to what I said at the start. I said, if there's meetings, I agree with ministers going on trips that are for the economy and employment here. And I'm going on first class. I agree with that totally. But not, I said, ministers going and people object to spending money on trips that don't affect anything of Northern Ireland. That
okay, but how do you know, right? So the way the world works, and look, the last thing I want to be, Brian, is patronising. You know how it works as well as I do. All of you do, as much as I do. But the way it works is relationships. That's what makes it business tick. That's what the difference. It's about creating relationships with people. And if you've got it, if you don't have it, you can't learn it. But if you're sitting side by side with a human being and you connect with them, that connection can bring you friendship in your personal life. That connection in the business world can be the difference from getting a contract or not. So that's why, surely, you send politicians on your behalf to foreign countries. It's about relationships and connections and building them.
But what's I mean, I've yet to see the outcome of many of these particular trips and meeting prominent people across the world. The only person that comes to mind that really brought business to, especially where he came from, Mercer, John Hume.
But do you not want them to try then? Do you want them all just to? Do you want us to sit in a bubble here in Northern Ireland and our ministers? You know, I don't know. All the other politicians from around the world, they're there on the ground, and our ministers are afraid to get a flight.
Yeah, but the people of Northern Ireland need to know what the outcome of all these trips at the end of the day, and say, well, that's good. I mean, do more of these trips. But I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I don't see it. That's my main point too.
Brian, thank you. Morning, Alex. Morning, Alex.
Morning, Lord. Just following the discussion here. You know, my ad should be, how does it compare with private industry? How would somebody at that level in private business be treated? And that applies also to the civil service. If you have a senior civil servant, you're going to say you want to recruit good people into civil service. You say you'll always have to fly economy. Whereas the guy who sat beside in university, who went into private business, he gets to fly business class. It doesn't work. You have to make the job attractive, and business, complaining about business class and so forth. You know, I would look at how people are treated in the private sector. I certainly see.
Well, there's a tension in that, isn't there? Look, there's no other program gives these ministers, any politician in Northern Ireland, as robust a ride as we do, right? But we've got to be grown up about this, Alex. So you've got on the one hand, you've got this, you know, politicians ultimately want to be in line with the people who are voting for them. And there will be many people voting for any of these political parties. They will have never travelled a business class flight transatlantic in their lives. They can't afford it. They're just about able to afford an economy seat, if they're able even to afford that. So how aloof does it seem to them, these discussions about business class flights? Like, it's a completely different planet for a lot of people listening to me this morning. On the other hand, there are then many, many people who are in business, who run businesses, who are executives, and a business class flight just comes with the job.
It's hard to know, Steve. I flew to Africa a few years ago. We flew economy, and I found it perfectly comfortable. And if I was a politician and I was flying to America, I might be inclined to fly economy. Well, it makes sure everybody knew about it. But the point I'm making is you have to include the civil servants in this. He was flying with the civil servants. If you have a senior civil servant who is looking across at somebody in a similar position in the private industry, how are they both treated? Are they both treated the same? I have a son. He works for a computer company. He doesn't have to pay for his Christmas too. When they go out for a Christmas party, it's all paid for. The civil service doesn't do that. You know, so you have to, if you want to attract good people into the civil service, you have to provide. It has to be comparable to what you get in private industry. I mean, you can't very well have the civil servant walking to the front of the plane for business while the minister goes back for economy. It wouldn't make sense.
So you support them going business? Is that the upshot?
I do, but I'm not sure. I was a councillor for a few years. You know, I went to some things. I remember talking to another colleague, another councillor, and you were told, come on in, but everybody else had the queue. I thought personally it was a better look to be standing in the queue, frankly. And there's a lot to be said for that sometimes. There's a lot to be said for standing in the queue, especially if you're a politician or a public representative. Queue with the people, queue alongside the people. That's not to say you should have to, but there's a lot to be said for doing it.
Alex, thank you. Good morning to you. There's some of you calling us today to wish me a happy Christmas, my last day on the Nolan Show for 2024. I want to say the same to all of you. I want to say happy Christmas and thank you for been with me all year, and thank you very much for just that absolute commitment you have to being with the programme every day. At the end of the day, the Nolan Show doesn't make many friends in terms of when we speak truth to power. It's awkward for them. Some of them don't like it. Some of them get it. But there is this massive support from all of you. And we know what our mandate is. I want to thank you because I'll not be here at the end of the year. I'll not be back until January. I'm off on my holidays. So a big, big thank you from me and the team. Our studio director this morning, Mel, has been with the BBC 26 years and it's Mel's last day today. So we'll miss you, Mel. And good luck for the future. And good luck to all of you here with your families and your friends over Christmas. So from all of us here at The Nolan Show, Happy Christmas, everyone, and have a Happy New Year.
See those faces. I'm driving home for Christmas, yeah. Well, I'm moving down that line, and it's been so long, but I will be there. I sing this song to pass the time away, driving in my car. Driving home for Christmas. It's gonna take some time, but I'll get there. Top to toe in tailbacks. Oh, I got red lights all around. But soon there'll be a freeway, yeah. Get my feet on holy ground. With a thousand memories, I take a look at the driver next to me. He's just the same, just the same.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.